It is Monday, March the 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, why did attackers go after Ivory Coast?
This is a much less directed, much less discerning sort of violence. There's no immediate political project in play with the Ivory Coast. It's really just showing that they can do this.
Also ahead, another deadly blast in Turkey. Tense times on the U.S. campaign trail for presidential contenders, plus benevolence in the world of music. Everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Al-Qaeda's North African affiliate has claimed an attack by six heavily armed assailants on an Ivory Coast resort that killed numerous civilians, two soldiers also dead on Sunday. Many more were wounded. Side Intelligence Group, which monitors jihadist websites, said Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM, claim responsibility for the attack in a post to its Telegram channels, calling three of the attackers heroes for the assault on three hotels in the beach resort of Grand Bassam. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Deakin University scholar Greg Barton how serious a blow this is for Ivory Coast.
It's a serious blow to Ivory Coast, but I don't think the neighbours, you know, Ghana, Burkina Faso, Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone are going to be feeling very comfortable either, because what happened in Ivory Coast could happen to them next. In the past, we thought this group, AQIM, which is, you know, basically an Algerian-based group, basically with a project to toppling the government in Algeria, but have been operating, of course, in Mali and Mauritania, in the north of Africa, was going to remain focused on northern Africa and the Sahel region. It's now crossed south of the Sahel down to the Atlantic coast. These attackers presumably came in through Mali, so they've gone the length of the Ivory Coast right down to the Atlantic coast. And that means, frankly, that whole region of West Africa is now at threat.
Why Ivory Coast? Why West Africa? What have they done to groups like this?
I think this is only really explicable in terms of the competition, the rivalry between Al-Qaeda broadly and ISIS broadly. Of course, the attacks in Sousse in Tunisia, both the attacks on the beach resort of Sousse and the earlier attack in the capital, Tunis, involved military-style attacks with assault rifles and explosives from people trained by ISIS and coming out of Libya. And, of course, Libya has been the focus of growing ISIS presence. But Al-Qaeda globally is worried about being eclipsed as a global jihadi brand by ISIS. And Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, in Algeria is worried that it's going to lose its potency on the African continent as ISIS shores up both an on-the-ground presence in places like Libya and Tunisia and encourages some sort of synergistic allegiance. It's reached out to Boko Haram and Shabab with uncertain consequences. But it's such a potent brand, there's a real sense of rivalry. And so we've seen a change in tactics. The tactics that we used on Sunday in Ivory Coast seem to mirror pretty much exactly the tactics used in Sousse. But the Sousse attack was clearly ISIS. This is clearly Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda in the past, particularly AQIM, has focused on kidnapping for ransom. There's a kind of, you know, brutal logic. They've raised well over $50 million from kidnapping for ransom. It was unjustifiable violence, but it was sort of rational. This is a much less directed, much less discerning sort of violence. There's no immediate political project in play with the Ivory Coast. It's really just showing that they can do this to build their brand. And that means that the threat is now more diffuse. These sort of attacks are easier to put together than the old-fashioned Al-Qaeda attacks of massive explosive programs or kidnapping for ransom. These are very easy to put together. All you need is, well, the weapons are not at any shortage. You just need people willing to give their life in a military assault-style attack. And unfortunately, they've probably got plenty of people they can throw at these sort of issues. So it's certainly bad news for Ivory Coast, but it's bad news for the entirety of northern Africa, certainly West Africa.
And they seem to be targeting the tourist industries of these countries.
Yeah, so what they're really targeting is the economies. They're basically saying we can tip your economies over. We can, by doing that, destabilize your governments. Now, we do know that AQIM historically would have liked to have taken control of Algeria, whether they really think they can put in place more sympathetic governments in the rest of northern Africa seems very unlikely, but they want to sort of show that in the sort of more crude logic of a cosmic struggle that they can destabilize and they can turn the tables. Perhaps they see in some cases, this seemed to have been the case in northern Mali, they might have been able to take ground and hold it. They're not in a position to do that in the rest of West Africa, but perhaps just by destabilizing governments, they feel that they can build their brand, draw more recruits, and in some sort of nebulous fashion work towards some sort of longer-term goal of eventually bringing these governments down and putting in place sympathetic governments.
Greg Martin, a professor at the Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalization. That's at Australia's Deakin University. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. Their conversation took place on Skype. It was another deadly attack Sunday in Turkey. Large explosion ripped through a main square in Turkey's capital, Ankara, killing at least 34 people. Well over 120 were being treated at various hospitals in the capital, many of them in critical condition. For more on the Ankara attack, we turn to Alp Esmer, a journalist in the VOA Turkish service. Alp, good to have you with us. As a native of Ankara, your thoughts on these attackers going right into the heart of the city?
The location of the bombing Sunday evening is Ankara's main square, where a lot of government offices are present. It is also very crowded commuter stop. And the area has been under constant police surveillance with lots of police presence there. And I was there just 2 months ago, and the square is constantly monitored with security cameras. Whether civilians have been intentionally targeted is another question, but the Turkish Prime Minister is very sure that the car bombing deliberately targeted civilians waiting for their buses there. And the main square in Kızılay, where my high school is nearby, is also where hundreds of thousands of people change their buses, metro trains to commute from one part of the city to the other. It's always a crowded area. Maybe the only blessing, I believe, was because it occurred in Sunday evening with minimal casualties, despite more than 30 people have been killed already. But apparently during a normal weekday, the number of casualties might have been far more.
Yeah. You know, Alpa, a lot of the previous attacks have been, the blame has been placed on the Kurdish insurgents, the so-called Kurdistan Workers Party, or the PKK. We talk a lot about that in the news. We're also hearing of recent times the threat by the Islamic State militants as well. The country seems under siege.
It's true. I mean, Ankara has experienced three bomb attacks in the past 6 months, and one of them was actually the act of ISIS. And what I can tell you is, Turkey has been battling on multiple fronts these days. Its Kurdish insurgency on one hand, the clashes in its Kurdish towns, the Islamic State terrorism, the civil war in neighboring Syria, the insecure borders, international dispute with Moscow and Damascus, they all make it very hard to speculate who might be behind this attack in Ankara. But the government has not yet pointed any fingers on any group or individuals so far. I mean, the interior minister said the investigators have collected various evidences in relation to who might be behind the attack, but he refrained from laying the accusation on someone. However, he said Turkey's determination to fight against terrorism will not be stopped by such attacks. Also, the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has made a similar statement, saying the Turkish government will not be deterred to use its right to self-defense against terrorism. All these references may point to the PKK or its affiliates, because the Turkish government's current war on terrorism practically is only against the Kurdish insurgents rather than the Islamic State. And I believe the government will not be too hasty to declare the alleged perpetrator of the attack, because it had acted too early to blame the YPG, the Kurdish forces in Syria fighting ISIS, just hours after the bomb attack last month in Ankara, which claimed 30 lives back then. But it later turned out to be another Kurdish group, a splinter organization of the PKK.
And many thanks to you, Alp. That's VOA's Alp Esmer, broadcaster in our Turkish service. Let's go a little deeper now on what's being said online about the Ankara attack. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here. G, what do you have?
Hi, Steve. Many media accounts are tweeting about it, including New York Times and the AP. The latest news related to the explosion is about a ban on access to Facebook and Twitter.
Very interesting. What's happening exactly there?
An Ankara court ordered a ban on a number of social media sites in Turkey Sunday after people began sharing images of the car bombing. The reason for the ban is to prevent showing victims of the tragedy on social media platforms. International broadcasters shared some of the earlier images, but local users can't access Facebook and Twitter at this point.
That's not the first time the Turkish government blocked access to social media sites, isn't that right?
That's right. It blocked access to Twitter last year over domestic political issues.
I got you, G. So what else is trending online today?
Steve, the U.S. politics continue to dominate the social media platform here in the States. The latest trending story is Florida Senator Marco Rubio winning the GOP presidential convention this weekend in D.C. Ohio Governor John Kasich came in a close second. Billionaire Donald Trump placed third. Also over the weekend, former Republican presidential contender Ben Carson endorsed Trump and sent out a few tweets about it. On the Democratic side, a skit about Hillary Clinton morphing into Bernie Sanders went viral. A member of the popular Saturday Night Live series poked fun at Clinton allegedly adopting many of Sanders' rhetoric in order to gain support for millennials. Billionaire investor George Soros is also in the headlines for contributing $15 million into a new super PAC to mobilize immigrant voters. Soros is an immigrant himself, born in Hungary. That's all for me today. Steve?
And many thanks to you, G, our own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. Coming up, we'll have more on the U.S. presidential race. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
This is VOA's International Edition, and we turn now to U.S. politics. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is blaming Democrat Bernie Sanders and his supporters for what he says was a planned disruption that forced him to cancel a Chicago rally on Friday night.
You know, Bernie was saying Mr. Trump should speak to his crowd. Mr. Trump, you know where they come from? Bernie's crowd. They're Bernie's crowd.
And while Trump was speaking with his supporters in Kansas, here in Washington, Republicans held a convention Saturday that has the same effect as a primary. International Edition's Michael Lippin went to the polling location where the Republican Party members voted for the presidential candidates they support. Republicans here are a very small minority in a city that traditionally votes overwhelmingly for candidates in the Democratic Party. Michael caught up with Tony Parker, he is treasurer of the Republican National Committee, and Joe Brookman of the D.C. Republican Party, who talks about what brought out voters on Saturday.
I think it has to do with where the election is and the candidates are at the moment. People want to come out and support their views, so it's really endorsing who they believe and what they believe. And if you'd like to, this is Tony Parker right here. Tony? This gentleman is from the Voice of America.
Okay. Hi, I'm Tony Parker.
Hi, nice to meet you.
With the RNC. He's the financial?
No, I'm the treasurer of the RNC. Treasurer of the RNC.
Okay. What do you think about the big turnout today for this primary?
I think it's incredible small D democracy. I think it's fabulous. There is a real yearning in the city for an alternative to the Democrats. And that's what you're seeing here today.
In terms of the organization of this primary, people are having to wait quite a long time in line. So do you think there should have been maybe some better planning here?
Some days you just get overwhelmed. And who would have thought that these many people would have shown up one Saturday afternoon? We have never had anything like this in the history of our party.
Okay.
So we never, in historically, we would have this kind of people, but they would come out to the 194
precincts.
We have only one. And the only reason we did is because the Democrats refused to allow to have their primary in a time that would allow us to be qualified so we could qualify for the convention. So they sort of stuck it to us. And so we've had to put it on ourselves. And we had no idea that we'd have this kind of a turnout.
Okay.
But it's incredible.
And what do you think is behind it?
I think people are really caring. I think they're people are really engaged in this election. I think they're tired of what they've seen in the last 8 years, and they want to change. And that's what you're seeing.
And your estimate of the turnout today?
I don't know. Joe, what do you think?
We thought we were going to have a couple thousand, three.
I thought it was going to be 1,000, 1,500.
Yeah.
I mean, holy, none of us in our wildest dreams would have thought we would have gotten this. I mean, it really is a testament to small D democracy.
And how important is the D.C., primary in the context of the overall election?
Well, we're the only primary today, so the focus is on the District of Columbia today. And every vote counts, and you have no idea. We've got 19 votes. We've got as many as like four or five other states. I mean, 19 votes may make a difference to somebody.
19 delegates.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Excuse me, delegates, and that may make a difference. So it's very important potentially.
As Tony Parker, he is the treasurer of the Republican National Committee. He and Joe Brookman of the Washington, D.C. Republican Party, speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. By the way, Marco Rubio won the Washington delegate count on Saturday with 10 of the 19 delegates, which were up for grabs. John Kasich took another 9. Donald Trump and Ted Cruz received no delegates. For the Democrats, presidential candidate Hillary Clinton still far out in front in the delegate count ahead of Bernie Sanders, who is relying on big support by young voters to keep his candidacy strong. 5 key states will hold primaries tomorrow. Those will include Florida, Illinois, and Ohio. They're winner-take-all states where the top finisher wins all the delegates instead of splitting them with the runner-ups. And speaking of Illinois, while much of the attention there tomorrow will focus on the candidates trying to win the party's presidential nomination, one Chicago community organizer and businessman will also be in the ballot, hoping to make some history in the state. VOA's Kane Faribault is in Chicago with his story.
The Illinois General Assembly's 40th district on Chicago's northwest side is the place Paul Sack calls home, even if he doesn't like the way he sees politics working locally.
Supposedly, we have thousands of politicians representing us at the city and county and state level and other districts, but really there's only a few guys that are in charge.
But a knock on the door to his apartment last year gave him new hope.
This campaigner told me a little bit about him. He seemed like he believed in the same things I believed in, and with the state and the mess that it's in, it seemed like it was the right time for me to get involved with something.
So on March 15th, Sack's top choice for the General Assembly is a Muslim American immigrant who has never before held public office. Harish Patel bills himself as an independent Democrat, someone who isn't beholden to the state party.
My state has not respected or responded to the needs of my community. So in this district, I just feel like there's a crisis of democracy.
When Patel came to the U.S. in 1999 with his widowed mother, he didn't speak any English.
And state assembly, what we do is we make laws for the state of Illinois.
But thanks to public programs, he got an education and a college degree. Now he wants to give back.
All of this is possible because of the investment that the community has made in me. And now it's sort of my time to figure out how to keep those programs so when other people are coming to this neighborhood, other people that live in this neighborhood, that built this neighborhood, have the access, same access that I got.
Chicago's 40th is one of the most ethnically diverse in the state. It is also home to three mosques and a large population of Muslim Americans. The primary is a two-man race between Patel and incumbent Jaime Andrade. Whoever wins is likely to win the general election in November because there is currently no Republican challenger. If Patel wins, he would make history as the first Muslim American immigrant elected to the Illinois General Assembly, something Paul Sack hopes to witness not just as a voter, but as a new member of Patel's campaign.
It is great that somebody who's from another country, somebody who didn't learn English until he was 14, is, might be my representative.
Winning the election may be the easy part. The General Assembly next year will face many issues, including how to solve the state's $9 billion annual budget deficit. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
And at any moment, President Obama could name his pick to fill the high court vacancy created by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia last month. Reports from the White House are saying the president has narrowed his list of potential nominees as the vetting process enters a final phase, even as Senate Republicans insist they will not consider any jurists Mr. Obama chooses. With the president in his last year in office, Republicans want Mr. Obama's successor to fill the vacancy. And Democrats are betting that the blanket preemptive Republican opposition to a Supreme Court pick will soften once a nominee actually emerges. You know, you can get more news always on our website at voanews.com. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of researchers say that they have discovered around 80 galaxies that may have existed in the young universe about 12.6 billion years ago. The team developed a list of galaxies to look for from data gathered by the Subaru telescope in Hawaii. With that information, they were able to locate these 80 early galaxies and learn more about them by analyzing imaging data gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope. About 13.6 billion years ago, that's 200 million years after the Big Bang, it's thought that cold gas clouds provided material for the first stars to be born. As these stars were being created, they formed small galaxies. The researchers were able to determine that around 1.2 billion years after the Big Bang, these small galaxies were continuously merging together and growing into larger galaxies like our own Milky Way, which contains about 200 billion stars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. On the heels of his two-time Grammy win and huge surge in popularity, country artist Chris Stapleton tackles mental health awareness in his new video for his song Fire Away, and it has created quite a buzz out there on social media. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition Sarah Williams to fill us in. Here's Sarah.
Nikki, what made Stapleton choose to take on mental health?
Well, the actor in the video, Ben Foster, reportedly introduced Stapleton to ChangeDirection.org, an organization which aims to create a culture in which mental health optimization is valued and achievable. So he was down for the cause, so to speak, and he became a part of the organization's recent campaign to increase mental health awareness by enabling people to identify the five key signs of emotional suffering, which include change in personality, agitation, withdrawal, decline in personal care, and hopelessness.
How does the video go about addressing the issue?
Well, the video is shot like a short film. Chris plays a bartender, and then the actor Ben Foster, who plays a cop, comes to the bar and starts to drink. And then the film goes into a flashback as if we're entering his mind and seeing everything he's thinking. And in his flashback, you see the story of a young married couple, he and his wife. They look like they're living the perfect life. They just move into a new home, they start to fix it up, and then something starts to change in his wife's character. We start to see how those five keys start to manifest and how the husband who loves her dearly is dealing with it. So it's very touching, it's riveting, it's moving. If you've ever had a loved one struggle with depression or if you've ever dealt with depression yourself, you can really relate to this video. And because it is told through his eyes, you even get a glimpse of how her mental health impacts his. You feel the pain he feels as he endeavors to help the wife he loves, and you feel his determination to love her through thick and thin. And the actors Ben Foster and Margarita Levieva, do a great job. So the video is well done. And at the end of it, the website changedirection.org flashes on the screen.
Well, mental health concerns are more common than we know.
Yeah, Change Direction's website says mental health concerns affect 1 in 5 Americans, like depression, anxiety, trauma, and that more people will die from suicide in 2016 than in auto accidents. And I think with this video, Chris Stapleton and changedirection.org is making the mental health awareness less taboo subject and less misunderstood. And ultimately, I think together they're trying to change how our culture overall deals with it. And the Fire Away video has been shared all over social media, so the word is getting out. Hopefully the change will go along with it.
You can see Chris Stapleton's video for Fire Away on his social media by going to facebook.com and looking up VOA Music, or on Twitter at @VOA_music. You can also hear more of Chris Stapleton's music on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. Thank you, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Unload up your questions and pick up your sticks and your stones. And pretend I'm a shelter for heartaches that don't have a home. Choose a word.
Yeah, cuts like a razor. Did you know it is Pi Day? That's right. It's celebrated each March 14th or 314 around the world. And you know, pi is the symbol used in mathematics to represent a constant, the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter, which is approximately 3.1459. In fact, there are trillions of digits. A lot of people spend all kinds of time trying to figure out those trillion digits. Not me. I'd rather eat pie. Well, listen, thanks everyone for joining us today on International Edition. Good to have you with us on VOA. Stay tuned. Latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The periodic warming of sea surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean, known as El Niño, causes weather and short-term climate changes in other parts of the globe. The El Niño of 2015-2016 is the strongest on record, and nowhere have been extreme weather effects associated with El Niño been more intensely felt than in Ethiopia. Last summer's Kiremt, or main rainy season, has been weak, and the short spring bell grains are delayed. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the resulting drought, the worst Ethiopia has experienced in 5 decades, has led to successive crop failures and widespread livestock deaths, tripling the humanitarian needs. Some 10.2 million Ethiopians are now chronically hungry, while some 7.5 million farmers and herders need immediate agricultural support to produce both grains and livestock in the coming season. Since October 2014, the United States has provided over $500 million in aid to Ethiopia and another $4 million worth of seeds, a critical need for farmers, given that the planting season will begin soon. But this year, we are taking an extra step, one we feel is necessary if we are to prevent this crisis from growing much, much worse. Instead of waiting for the situation to develop into a full-blown emergency, we are sending in a disaster assistance response team, a group of experts that will evaluate the situation on the ground, pinpoint gaps in the aid plan, and accelerate and expand the emergency response, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. We are moving earlier in this case because we have found that there is real agreement between donors, NGOs, the government, and UN agencies that if we move very, very quickly, we can avert the worst impacts of this drought. We hope that by taking this step, we will lead the rest of the international community, said Administrator Smith. If we move now, if other donors move with us, we think we can do 2 things. Avert the worst impacts and protect some of the development gains that the country has made over many years, she said. We are challenging the world not just to respond to human suffering, but to respond quickly enough to prevent something even worse.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.